This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. Commentator and George Mason University economics professor Walter Williams takes on a range of issues in his new book, everything from the Constitution to foreign policy. American Contempt for Liberty is a collection of essays selected from his syndicated newspaper columns. In it, he lays out his case for what he calls the moral superiority of personal liberty and its main ingredient, limited government. Dr. Williams joins us today, and thank you so much for joining us, Dr. Williams.
Thank you very much for the invitation, Mark.
Well, American Contempt for Liberty, the title seems pretty harsh and stark. Is that really how bad things have become? I mean, aren't we still among the freest, if not the freest nation in the world?
Well, if you ask the question, how do Americans feel now compared to the time of our founding? One example of this is that we all acknowledge that James Madison is the father of the Constitution. And in 1794, Congress appropriated $15,000 to help some French refugees. James Madison stood on the floor of the House irate, and he said, and I'm quoting him, "I cannot undertake to lay my finger on that article in the Constitution that authorizes Congress to spend the money of their constituents for the purposes of benevolence." And he also said that a charity is not a legitimate function of the legislature. And now keep in mind that he's again the father of the Constitution, so he should know what's in there. But imagine a president running for office today, a person running for office today, saying that that charity is not a legitimate function of government, that government should not be involved in spending on the objects of benevolence, when our federal budget shows that 2/3 to 3/4 of it is for the objects of benevolence. How do you think Americans would greet that? They would greet it with contempt, I think. And they would run such a presidential candidate or a senatorial or congressional candidate out of town. That is, the big moral problem confronting us is that today's Americans believe that Congress should forcibly use one American to serve the purposes of another American, whether it be forcing you to serve the purposes of a farmer, through farm subsidies, or bail out big banks and businesses, or give out handouts to poor people and food stamps and Medicaid and Medicare. Most Americans believe that Congress should be doing that, and so for me, I think that's a violation of personal rights. Now, I'm not making an argument against taxation, because we all should pay our share of the constitutionally mandated functions of the federal government. But we don't owe anything to another human being. So I think that this shows the level of contempt that American people have for the notions of liberty.
Well, who's contributed to this contempt for liberty? Has it been both sides of the political spectrum, both sides of the political aisle?
Of course, yeah. That is Republicans and conservatives. They believe in taking your money and my money and giving it to farmers and businesses. Democrats or liberals, they believe in taking your money and my money and giving it to cities and poor people. They both agree on taking our money. They just disagree on what to spend it for. And so there's a lot for Governor Wallace, who said years and years ago that there's not a dime's worth of difference between Republicans and Democrats. And he might have been exaggerating, but they both engage in what I consider legalized theft. And you say, for example, imagine the following. Suppose I'm running for the Senate from the state of Ohio, and I go back and forth across the state, and I say, look, my fellow Ohioans, I've read the United States Constitution. If I take an oath of office, uphold and defend the Constitution, that's what I'm going to do. I will only do those things that are enumerated in the Constitution. So don't expect for me to bring back highway construction funds, aid to higher education, prescription drugs, Medicaid. Do you think that I would get elected by the citizens of Ohio?
No. I don't. Oh.
And so let me just finish that. And the citizens of Ohio would be exactly right by not electing me to the Senate. The reason why is that if I don't bring back all those goodies for Ohio, it doesn't mean that Ohioans will pay a lower federal income tax, All that it means is that Indiana or Pennsylvania will get it instead. That is, once legalized theft begins, it pays for everybody to participate.
So how have we reached this point?
Well, it's probably not clear breaking points. I think that some of it was the thinking of the Woodrow Wilson administration, then the Hoover, and later on the Roosevelt administration during the Great Depression, the calamity of the Great Depression, where people demanded more government, and then finally I would say the Johnson era with the huge jump in federal spending. And so, and then one thing that people don't pay a lot of attention to, I think that we're living with the outgrowth or of the results of the Civil War. That is, what the Constitution of our country would have never been ratified in 1787 if states did not think that they had the right to secede. It would have never been ratified. Now, the issue of secession was settled through a very brutal war, and now it's that states cannot secede. And once you establish that states cannot secede, then the federal government can do anything it wants to the states. It's very much like if you tell your wife, if your wife can't divorce you, well, then you treat her any way you want to. The fact that she can exit or divorce you, that makes you behave a little bit better. And the same thing with the states. The 10th and 9th Amendments don't mean anything now, because the federal government can just run roughshod over the states.
Yeah, Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution has that general welfare clause that gives lawmakers the authority to provide for the general welfare of the United States. Isn't our government doing just that when it creates programs like Social Security, like Medicare, like unemployment benefits or the Affordable Care Act?
Well, if you want to know what the founders said about it, Thomas Jefferson said, Congress had not unlimited powers to provide for the general welfare, but were restrained by those specifically enumerated. And then Madison said that if the Congress can do anything, I'm quoting them, if they can do anything they please to provide for the general welfare, then limited government means nothing. And so okay, here's another quote. If Congress can do whatever in their discretion can be done by money that will promote the general welfare, the government is no longer a limited one possessing enumerated powers, but an indefinite one. And that's what we have now, an indefinite government. See, Congress can do anything upon which it can get a majority vote. But that was not the vision of the founders of our country.
Well, how do we take go ahead, Dr. Williams.
So what I'm saying is that the general welfare clause has been misinterpreted and abused, and I think that the American people they just don't know anything about the Constitution. I mean, it's just, you know, just the idea that if you look at the Constitution, it will show that the framers of the Constitution had great distrust for Congress. They did not trust the United States Congress, and look at the language of the Bill of Rights. It says, Congress shall not disparage. Congress shall not infringe. Congress shall not prohibit. Well, if the framers of our nation did not believe Congress would do that, why in the world would they put that in there?
Hmm. Well,
and I suggest to people that when we die, and if at our next destination we see anything like a Bill of Rights, we know that we're in hell, because a Bill of Rights would be an insult in heaven to God.
So how do we take on issues of great magnitude, though, if it's not through the authority and the size of the federal government? Who leads the way?
Well, if you ask the question, from 1787 until about 1925, the federal government was only 3% of the GDP. Today, it is 25% of the GDP. The federal government, through that interval I just mentioned, was only 3% of the GDP, except during wartime. And during that interval from 1787 until 1925, we went from a third world country to the most powerful country, to a very rich country. And we did it without government spending. without the kind of government spending that people say we need today. You know, people say, oh, well, you need food stamps. We have to have a food stamp program because otherwise people are going to starve. Well, I asked them, well, when the poor Irish were coming here in the 1840s, fleeing the potato famine, landing here with nothing but the clothes on the back, how'd they make it? There was no food stamp program. And so whenever somebody tells you that you need, that we just have to have the government spending program, I always ask myself, what did we do before? And there's no evidence of people dying on the streets in our country.
But you're not against helping your fellow Americans. That's not what you're saying, right?
No, I believe it is praiseworthy and laudable to help your fellow man by reaching into one's own pockets to do so. I think that reaching into somebody else's pockets to help your fellow man should be condemned. It's despicable. And I believe that for the Christians among us, when God gave Moses the commandment, thou shalt not steal, he did not mean thou shalt not steal unless you got a majority vote in Congress.
What would you say to someone who says to you, you're so behind the times? I mean, the Constitution, the Founding Fathers, they're so 18th century.
Well, you know, I would tell them that the average person, I'm in the minority. That is, we have to recognize that throughout mankind's history, he's been subject to arbitrary control and abuse by others. There's been a lack of respect for human rights and property rights throughout mankind's history. That's the normal state of affairs, arbitrary abuse and control by others. Now, just for a tiny part of mankind's history, for the last 200 years or so, 300 years maybe, and mostly in the Western world, there's been a modicum of liberty where people own their own property, people and the government had to respect their property, and there was a considerable amount of freedom. But I'm all too afraid that maybe 150 years now, some historian would be writing, well, you know, man, there was this tiny curiosity where people were free for 100, 200 years, but it all went back to the normal state of affairs, arbitrary abuse and control by others. And if you ask the question, which way is our nation headed, tiny steps at a time, are we headed towards more liberty, more personal liberty, or are we headed towards more government control over our lives? I think it would unambiguously be the latter.
You know, it's one of the most important elements of our Constitution, freedom of speech. And I wonder, how do you think that's doing these days?
Well, the true test, you can answer yourself, the true test of one's commitment to freedom of speech doesn't come when he allows people to be free to say and publish those things with which he agrees. The true test of one's commitment to freedom of speech comes when he allows people to be free to say and publish those things that he finds despicable. And so it turns out that increasingly people around the world and people in the United States are hostile to that notion of liberty. Another example, freedom of association. The true test of one's commitment to freedom of association doesn't come when you allow people to be free to associate in those ways that you deem to be okay. It allows people to be free to associate in ways that you find despicable, such as not allowing a person into a bar because of his race, or not allowing a person to join a golf club or because of their sex. Well, I mean, I might find those acts despicable, but if it's private property and they don't get any money from the government, that's their right to do that.
Should we be concerned that we're heading to a similar situation about freedom of speech that's being faced in other parts of the world?
Well, if you look at take the case, I believe in Oklahoma, where a fraternity guys made very despicable remarks that were anti-black remarks, and they were suspended and the fraternity shut down, and this is a public school, and so I think that those remarks are despicable, but nonetheless, if you believe in freedom of speech, you have to allow people to make despicable remarks. So in that sense, freedom of speech, at one time, freedom of speech was very restrained, you know, in earlier in our history, and then during the 40s and 50s, there was a great increase in freedom of speech, but then now it's being it's facing problems, particularly on college campuses.
Yeah, the atmosphere on college campuses, it certainly doesn't seem conducive to it to free speech these days. And you'd think that free speech. Yeah,
that is absolutely right. And what goes on, and the average American does not know, is just plain it's indoctrination. Professors use their classes to proselytize students, to teach students what to think as opposed to how to think. And that goes on at probably at most of our universities.
And when it comes to the economic systems of the world, do you think that capitalism gets a bad rap?
Oh, yes. I think, that capitalism means peaceable voluntary exchange between people. Now, I'm not talking about crony capitalism. I find that despicable, where people use government, businessmen use government to rig the economic game. But I'm talking about free market capitalism has done more for mankind than any other system. I mean, if the essence of capitalism or the essence of free markets is that the only way that you can have a claim on what your fellow man produces is by serving your fellow man. I mean, if I mow your lawn and you give me $30, well, what's that $30? It's really a certificate of performance, because after I mow your lawn, I go down to the grocer and I say, well, I'd like to have a six-pack of beer and a pound of steak that my fellow man produced. And so the grocer, in effect, says, well, you're asking your fellow man to serve you. What did you do to serve him? I say, I mowed his lawn. And the guy says, prove it. And that's when I put the $30. You can think of the $30 as certificates of performance. And I think it's a height of morality to have a system that requires that in order to have a claim on what your fellow man produces, you have to serve your fellow man. Contrast that with the government. The government can say, look, Williams, you don't have to get out there in the hot sun and mow that guy's lawn in order to have a claim on what he produces. We'll just take what he produces and give it to you. I think that's immoral.
Now, you mentioned crony capitalism, and I've heard you say that what our nation needs is a separation of business and state, as it has a separation of church and state. Is that what you're getting at?
Oh, yes, you're right. You know, see, what people use government is to rig the economic game, whether it's at Washington or whether it's at state capital. Let me give you one example. In many cities, and it hurts poor people or people who are somehow disadvantaged, many poor people do have enough money to get a car, to get an automobile. And all they have to do is write the word taxi on it, and they're in business for themselves. This is our history. You know, poor, illiterate Italian in the 1920s, if he was industry and ambition, he goes out and gets a car and puts taxi on it. He was in business for himself. Today, that's not the case. I mean, in New York, for example, in order to own and operate one taxi, you have to go out and buy a $700,000 medallion. In Philadelphia, it's a license price that is $400,000. In many cities, it's the PUC that regulates who can enter the cab business. So what I'm saying, that's crony capitalism. That is, people are using the political system and the legal system to rig the economic game in their favor, and I find that despicable.
You're critical of the question, what can be done to save our nation from decline? And you say that shows a misunderstanding of history and a bit of arrogance. So why do you say that?
Well, I ask the question. People ask me, well, what can be done to save us from decline? And I say, well, look, are the American people, as human beings, are they any different from the Romans? Are they any different from the Portuguese, the Spanish, the French, the Brits? Are they any different? And I just listed these great empires of the past that went down the tubes. They're no longer great empires. And I think that I ask, what is there about Americans to prevent us from succumbing to the same fate? Now, maybe that sounds pessimistic, but I would say that, and I am pessimistic, but one of the things, one of the hopes, or one of the optimistic notes on the horizon, is that during the first 2 years of the Obama administration, where the Democrats held the House and the Senate and the White House, these people became so brazen in what they were doing that for the first time in my life, I'm almost 80 years old, people began debating about the Constitution. You had the formation of the Tea Party movement. You had states' attorney generals suing the federal government. A number of state legislatures passed 10th Amendment resolutions. So there's a tiny spirit of rebellion across the land, but whether it's too little, too late, that's a question that we can only answer several decades from now.
Well, you're an advocate for limited government. How do we get back to that? I mean, aren't we too far down the road at this point?
Well, we might be too far down the road. What we have to do, the only way to get back to limited government, is to somehow convince our fellow Americans on the moral superiority of personal liberty and its main ingredient, limited government. And if we can't do that, then I think it's over for us as a great nation, because we did not become great by doing the things that we're currently doing. That is, as I mentioned earlier, we became great because government played a very, very small role in our lives. That is, we went from a poor nation in 1776 to a wealthy nation by 1925, with government playing only a small role, being 3% of the GDP. Matter of fact, state and local government spent more than the federal government. That is, total state and local spending came to 9% of the GDP. So I think the American people have to recognize that we became rich because of limited government. And matter of fact, if you look at around the world, you say, well, where are people rich and where are they poor? Well, they tend to be richer in those countries that are closer to the free market end of the political spectrum, and they tend to be poorer in those countries that are at the opposite end, the socialist or the communist end of the political spectrum.
So what would be if there is one big first step that we should take as a country toward cutting off this loss of liberty that we're experiencing, what would that one first step be?
I do not know.
That's the magic question, isn't it?
I do not know.
Well, thank you for joining us today. And Dr. Walter Williams, his columns appear in the Cincinnati Inquirer on Sundays, and his new book is American Contempt for Liberty.